Hello, bibliophiles, and welcome to The Book Report, a new show all about books of every kind. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and together we're going to explore the dynamic world of books. You'll meet some famous authors and some soon-to-be famous authors. We'll take a look into the business of publishing, because we all know every reader has the great American novel inside them waiting to come out. And we'll even sneak into the stacks of the Library of Congress, where your book-loving host, yes, that's me, used to work. We're also going to talk about the fast-changing technology of reading. There are ebooks, Kindles, iPhones, iPads, and a whole bunch of other ways to consume books, and we'll discuss all of them. And because this is radio, we'll have a special segment each week on one of the fastest-growing areas of the book biz, the audiobook. We'll be featuring samples of the amazing array of audio titles out there, so be sure to stay tuned. Today, for example, we'll be hearing from Anthony Bourdain and Tony Blair. Talk about diverse. Above all, we'll have some fun together as we indulge our shared passion for reading. I know I was hooked at the tender age of 12 when, for the first time, I stayed up all night reading Jane Eyre. Ooh, Mr. Rochester, was there ever anyone sexier than that brooding, tortured man? And fellows, you can't tell me that at some point in your younger days, you didn't wish to be aboard Captain Jack Aubrey's ship. Sure, Russell Crowe did a great job in the movie Master and Commander. But when you first read the book, your mind did a much better job of painting a picture of that swashbuckler, didn't it? And that's why we love reading. There's just no other experience like it. I hope you'll come away from each show with new ideas about what's worth reading now. So, dear readers, join me after this little break and we'll get right into it.
Who do I think I am? Guess I don't know. That I ought to lay this burden down, just let it go. Maybe we put a strong cup of hate. I ought to not have drank it. Now it's much too.
Readers, as book lovers, I know that you, like me, are interested in the backstory of publishing. To peek inside the process of how a story evolves into a bestseller tomorrow. Today we're going to look at how the biggest headline of 2010, the story of the Gulf oil spill, is being crafted into a book that will be, I'm sure, a bestseller when it's released next March. It's my pleasure to have as my guest Tom Schroeder, who is co-authoring a book on the disaster aboard the oil rig Deepwater Horizon, where the tragedy struck on April 20th. But first, a little backstory on our guest. Tom Schroeder has been an award-winning journalist, writer, and editor for more than 30 years. As editor of the Washington Post magazine, he conceived and edited the story Fatal Distraction, which was awarded the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. In addition to being an author and editor of narrative journalism, Tom is one of the foremost humor editors in the country, editing columns by Dave Barry, Gene Weingarten, and Tony Kornheiser. And you'll be interested to know that Tom himself comes from writer stock. His father was a writer, and his grandfather, McKinley Cantor, won the Pulitzer Prize for his Civil War novel, Andersonville. I know Tom personally from his days as editor of the Miami Herald's Tropic magazine, which earned two Pulitzers during his tenure. In that same period, with humorist Dave Barry and novelist Carl Hiaasen and Elmore Leonard, he concocted and edited Naked Came the Manatee, a satirical serial novel that became a New York Times bestseller. I hope you've read it. Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you.
So, the book is coming out this March. Is it titled yet?
Yes, it's called Fire on the Horizon, and it's a HarperCollins book.
You are co-authoring the book with John Conrad, a former oil rig captain for the same company, a man whose best friend was a survivor of the disaster, and who personally knows Kurt Kuchta, captain of the ill-fated Deepwater Horizon. Captain Conrad also intimately knows the world of offshore drilling. How did you meet him?
Well, it actually happened because John Conrad contacted my agent, Gail Ross, in Washington. And she saw his proposal and thought we'd be a good matchup. And so she contacted me, and then John lives in California. And we spent hours together on Skype coming up with a book proposal, which we then sent out, and then we had a number of publishers that were interested, and then we decided to go with HarperCollins.
Our listeners need to know that this is a story of the events leading up to the tragedy, the death of 11 crew members, and the events immediately after. This book is not a look at the ecological impact of the spill. How exactly did you and Captain Conrad decide what the book would cover?
Well, we were, you know, sort of looking into it and going into it, we felt that so much attention was being paid to the oil spill and the ecological consequences, which are, you know, really important, of course, but we felt that not enough attention was being paid to the people who had to suffer through this really terrible tragedy, and the 11 who died. And it's just such an amazingly dramatic story. And the thing is that the life of the offshore oil rig worker is obscure to most of us. We don't think about where our oil comes from. But these guys are doing, something akin to like going to the moon. It's that technologically complicated and difficult to get oil 18,000 feet below the surface and a mile under the waves. I mean, think about it. How would you go about getting oil out from a mile deep under the ocean? And they have this very proud tradition and culture, and they're very interesting people, very tough job that they do very well. And, you know, I was just sort of captivated by that, and I thought that to understand this tragedy in the full context of, you know, the culture of offshore drilling would be a fascinating study, and I really, you know, never lost that feeling as I was working on it.
Obviously, there's a great appetite to hear the story behind the headlines. What deadlines did the publisher lay out for the project?
Well, that was the tricky part. because we really didn't sign a deal until the second week of July, and the anniversary was April 20th. And a lot of books were being signed and were going to come out for the anniversary, and they wanted to get ahead of that curve somewhat. They wanted to bring it out in March. And in the publishing world, usually, I mean, it's not unheard of for you to turn a book in and for it to be more than a year between the time you finish writing the book and the publication date. So to do it in, you know, to have a book come out March 1st that you're starting July, in the middle of July, is almost insane. And in fact, what we settled on was a deadline of the first week in November. So basically, I signed on to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day from the mid-July and through to the end of this month. So my brain is a little bit like Swiss cheese at the moment.
How much on-the-scene investigating have you done?
Well, we went to New Orleans for the Coast Guard hearings, and I went to New York and to California to interview people involved with the survivors. And then John has spent a lot of time in Houston and in New Orleans. The Houston is where the oil companies and the are headquartered. And then we did an enormous amount of phone and research.
Because the book is co-written by a colleague of Captain Kukta's, how would you answer readers who feel it may be overly sympathetic to him? What kind of reaction do you expect?
Well, he's not really a colleague because he never worked directly with him. He was he did work on an oil rig for the same company. But I think, you know, I think that you'll be able to see in the writing of it, it's pretty transparent as to how people are dealt with, and I don't think that we've painted an image that is not completely substantiated, in the record. So I think it pretty much won't raise those questions. And, of course, you never know how people are going to react. And the people who went through this are very sensitive. And, you know, this was a horrible thing that will stay with them the rest of their lives. And so I think that they'll sort of look at any book that comes out, you know, with a little bit of skepticism, as if, you know, are, you know, is this somebody who's trying to exploit our tragedy? And I just hope that they see this for what we've tried to make it, which is a really honest and compelling narrative about what happened to them.
Thank you so much for your candor, Tom, and for taking time from your impossibly tight schedule to speak with us today.
Well, I really appreciate it, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Fire on the Horizon, available this coming March from HarperCollins. Readers, you'll want to look for it. Thanks. We have more great books by favorite authors and amazing readers coming up, so stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break. Okay, I'm back for an exciting section of today's show, the audiobook report. All right. I see many of you purists out there turning up your noses at the idea of audiobooks, as though listening to a book is cheating somehow, because you don't have to scan the pages yourself. Okay, let's agree on a couple of things. Let's agree that Shakespeare was a pretty good writer. Well, he never meant you to sit down and try and parse his language by poring over a book. He meant you to hear the cadence of the language, the poetry, the romance of the spoken word. And that's what audiobooks gives you. The chance to hear the drama and the intensity of the story, and in a place that's convenient to you. Of course, the audiobook is also dependent on the quality, not just of the writing, but of the performance. And that's why the book report is one of the only places you'll get to sample the wares before you invest your time. You may be listening in your car right now, and I can tell you that once you get into the habit of entering the author's world every time you step into your car, it'll beat the heck out of sitting in traffic and listening to the same repeated songs on your commute. Uh-oh, I think I may have just committed heresy by suggesting you turn off your radio and turn on a book. But that's the story. You can get audiobooks at your public library, but also at every bookstore and, of course, major booksellers online. Downloading audiobooks is one of the fastest ways to get the audiobooks you want. So let's just jump right into one of my favorites. Readers, you know where you can find me every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m.? I'm going to be in front of the flat screen tuned to Jon Stewart's Daily Show. I love this guy, and I love the wacky cast. Their take on current events is laser sharp, and the show's appeal is so broad, you just have to sit up and take notice. Stewart fans can now treat themselves to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart Presents Earth, the audiobook. Where do we come from? Who created us? Why are we here? These questions have puzzled us since the dawn of time. But when it became apparent to Jon Stewart and his writers that the world was about to end, they embarked on a massive mission to write a book that summed up the human race. What we look like, what we accomplished, our achievements in society, government, religion, science, and culture. With their trademark wit, irreverence, and intelligence, Stewart and his team will posthumously answer all of life's hard-hitting questions, completely unburdened by objectivity, journalistic integrity, or even accuracy. So, here is a clip from Earth. Listen closely, and you'll hear not only Stewart reading, but Sigourney Weaver, Wyatt Cenac, and John Oliver. Here goes.
Antarctica.
Nickname, the latent catastrophe. Antarctica is a barren land of bitter cold, almost completely covered in permafrost. Well, at least it should be. If it is not, that could go a long way towards explaining why we're no longer here. Antarctica was not divided into countries. It was the one landmass on Earth nobody wanted. So in the end, it decided to start coming to us.
Habitats. Polar regions. The harsh and frigid conditions of our extreme northern and southern latitudes supported only the cutest of animals. Penguins, seals, polar bears all came protected with adorable walks, thick layers of huggable fat, and childlike eyes that shamed off all but the club-happiest hunters. What we got from them? Liquid water, starting around 1991. What to look for? A rescue ship. What to eat? In order, rations, half rations, the sled dogs, each other. Surprising fact, neither the East nor West Poles were ever discovered.
Natural disasters.
A number of Earth's natural processes had the unfortunate side effect of destroying everything we'd ever worked for. Events like those listed here not only decimated us, they also deeply tested our faith in God. We'll have more on him later. We optimistically chose to see these disasters not as signs that God did not love us, but that he loved us so much he would unexpectedly smite us with his mighty wrath for our own good.
Earthquakes.
The sudden shifting of tectonic plates will cause the ground to shake violently, toppling skyscrapers and rendering all but the shortest putts impossible. Residents of seismically active areas coped by developing quake-resistant buildings and probability-resistant psyches. Characteristic damage? Buildings flattened like pancakes, pancakes flattened like crepes. Safety tip. Stay away from chandeliers, shelves containing bowling balls, and California.
Floods.
Swollen rivers led to what urban planners called sudden liquid gentrification. We fought floods for thousands of years with, in decreasing level of effectiveness, dams, levees, sandbags, boating lessons, swimming lessons, and gill installation. Characteristic damage. All houses damaged. Swayed houses damaged irreparably. Safety tip. Gather together two of every animal and build thee an ark 300 cubits long. That ought to do it.
Droughts.
You've noticed that a lot of these disasters involve too much water. Well, guess what? Too little water was also a problem. Alas, droughts were slow-motion disasters, and thus unsuited as the subjects for summer blockbusters.
Hurricanes.
AKA typhoons or cyclones, depending on ethnicity of victims. For a storm to be officially upgraded to a hurricane, the proudest moment in any storm's life, it had to produce either sustained winds of over 75 miles per hour or sustained FEMA funding of over $200 million a week. Characteristic damage. Perfectly good first names tarnished forever. Safety tip. Just strap yourself to a palm tree and ride it out.
Tornadoes.
AKA twisters, cyclones, and rotating columns of fast-moving air from cumulonimbus clouds. They were most common in America's Great Plains, large swaths of which were rendered flat, desolate, and unlivable, then struck by tornadoes. Characteristic damage? Cow impaled by trailer. Safety tip. Quickly, head to the cellar. Is everybody in? Is everybody in? Quick head count, is everybody in? Where's Grandpa? Where's Grandpa? Oh God, Grandpa! Grandpa, no!
Tony Blair is a politician who defines our times. His emergence as Labour Party leader in 1994 marked a seismic shift in British politics. Within a few short years, he had transformed his party and rallied the country behind him, becoming Prime Minister in 1997 with the biggest victory in Labour's history, and bringing to an end 18 years of the Conservative government. He took Labour to a historic three terms in office as Britain's dominant political figure of the last two decades. A Journey is Tony Blair's firsthand account of his years in office and beyond. Here he describes for the first time his role in shaping recent history, From the aftermath of Princess Diana's death to the War on Terror, he reveals the leadership decisions necessary to reinvent his party, the grueling negotiations for peace in Northern Ireland, the implementation of the biggest reforms to Britain's public services since 1945, and his relationships with world leaders like Nelson Mandela, Bill Clinton, Vladimir Putin, and our own George W. Bush. A Journey is a deeply personal book about the nature and uses of political power. This is no textbook. In frank, unflinching, often wry detail, Tony Blair charts the ups and downs of his career to provide insight into the man, as well as the politician and the statesman. This abridged book is read by Tony Blair himself. Let's listen.
Chapter 1. High Expectations. On the 2nd of May 1997, I walked into Downing Street as Prime Minister for the first time. I had never held office, not even as the most junior of junior ministers. It was my first and only job in government. The election night of the 1st of May had passed in a riot of celebration, exhilaration, and expectation. History was not so much being made as jumping up and down and dancing. 18 years of Conservative government had ended. Labour, New Labour, had won by a landslide. It felt as if a fresh era was beginning. As I walked through the iron gates into Downing Street, and as the crowd pressed forward in enthusiasm, I could feel the emotion like a charge. It ran not just through the crowd, but through the country. It affected everyone, making them believe all things were possible, that by the very act of election and the spirit surrounding it, the world could be changed. Everyone, except for me, that is. My predominant feeling was fear, and of a sort unlike anything I had felt before, deeper even than the fear I had felt the day I knew I was going to take over the leadership of the Labour Party. Until election night, this fear had been kept in check by the routine, rigour, and sheer physical and mental exertion of the campaign. Also, campaigning was familiar emotional as well as political territory. I had a strategy for guiding us from opposition into government. I adhered to it, and I knew that if I did so, I wouldn't fail. I had redefined the Labour Party as New Labour, a changed progressive force in British politics. I had set out an outline programme of sufficient substance to be credible, but lacking in the details that would have allowed our opponents to damn it. And I had fashioned a strong but believable attack on the government and assembled a ferociously effective election-fighting machine. In order to instill discipline into the party and even my close team, I was the eternal warrior against complacency. I regularly spoke about how big opinion poll leads could be lost, how the Tories should never be underestimated, how we had this problem and that challenge. Since we had lost 4 elections in a row and had never won 2 consecutive full terms, I was cultivating fairly fertile ground. The party had almost come to believe that it couldn't win, no matter what it did. I thought that was complete baloney. We had lost because we were out of touch with the modern voter in the modern world. The first rule in politics is that there are no rules, at least not in the sense of inevitable defeats or inevitable victories. If you have the right policy and the right strategy, you always have a chance of winning. Without them, you can lose no matter how certain the victory seems. Pretending that it was all really on a knife edge helped motivate us and kept us in line. Though underneath I was very confident, you never know. What's more, I believed the current Prime Minister John Major was much better than most others thought. He had real appeal as a person. Fortunately, his party had gone off the rails to a heavy, hard right position. And over the seemingly interminable time I'd spent as leader of the opposition, almost 3 years, I'd learnt how to play him and his party off against each other. Major had decided on a long campaign of 3 months. It was tough, of course, but it wasn't an uncharted landscape, and it fitted a pattern. The hope was that we would trip up, I would suddenly lose my head, by some trick of fate or fortune the mood of the public would switch. It was never really going to happen. Instead, and rather more predictably, the Tories fell apart. Every time Major tried to get them on the front foot, someone in his ranks resigned, said something stupid, got caught in a scandal, and frequently all three at once and occasionally the same person. The election campaign was long, enervating, full of phony ups and downs, shock polls and startling happenings. But in the end, the result was obvious. The scale of the victory, however, was not clear. On the night of 1st of May, it became clear just how big. And that was when the fear started to set in. The actual day of the election had passed uneventfully. Campaigning stopped and I went to vote. I walked out of our constituency home in Trimden Colliery, an old mining village near Sedgefield in County Durham, where I'd been MP for 14 years. I strode to the polling station with Sheree and the children, the ideal family picture, while a horde of snappers took our photograph.
Coming up is a clip from the just-published book of Condoleezza Rice, Extraordinary, Ordinary People. And readers, this one isn't quite what you may expect. It is not a look at Rice's tenure as Secretary of State, nor her reflections on the Bush presidency. It's a very candid autobiography, focusing on her coming of age during the turbulent civil rights years in Birmingham, Alabama. Rice was born in 1954 into Birmingham's black middle class, a group that had been able to insulate their children from the harshest effects of racism. But by 1963, when Rice was in fourth grade, the situation had become intolerable. Birmingham blacks were expected to keep their head down and do what they were told, or face violent consequences. In fact, that spring, two bombs exploded in Rice's neighborhood in a series of Ku Klux Klan attacks. And several months later, four young girls lost their lives in a vicious bombing. So, how was Rice able to achieve what she did? Her father, John, was a minister and an educator, and he instilled a love of politics and sports. Her mother, a teacher, developed Condoleezza's passion for piano and exposed her to the fine arts. From both, Rice learned that the value of faith in the face of hardship and the importance of giving back to the community. Her parents' fierce unwillingness to set limits propelled her to Stanford, where she rose through the ranks to become the university's second in command. An expert in Soviet and Eastern European affairs, she played a leading role in U.S. policy as the Iron Curtain fell and the Soviet Union disintegrated. Less than a decade later, she would go on to the White House as the first female national security advisor, and on from there to Secretary of State. As comfortable describing lighthearted family moments as she is recalling the poignancy of her mother's cancer battle and the heady challenge of going toe-to-toe with Soviet leaders, Rice holds nothing back in this remarkably candid telling. This is the story of Condoleezza Rice that has never been told, not that of an ultra-accomplished world leader, but of a little girl and a young woman trying to find her place in a sometimes hostile world, and of two exceptional parents and an extended family and community that made all the difference. And now, Extraordinary, Ordinary People, written and read by Condoleezza Rice.
My parents were anxious to give me a head start in life, perhaps a little too anxious. My first memory of confronting them and in a way declaring my independence was a conversation concerning their ill-conceived attempt to send me to first grade at the ripe age of three. My mother was teaching at Fairfield Industrial High School in Alabama, and the idea was to enroll me in the elementary school located on the same campus. I don't know how they talked the principal into going along, but sure enough, on the first day of school in September 1958, my mother took me by the hand and walked me into Mrs. Jones' classroom. I was terrified of the other children and of Mrs. Jones, and I refused to stay. Each day we would repeat the scene, and each day my father would have to pick me up and take me to my grandmother's house, where I would stay until the school day ended. Finally, I told my mother that I didn't want to go back because the teacher wore the same skirt every morning. I'm sure that this wasn't literally true. Perhaps I somehow already understood that my mother believed in good grooming and appropriate attire. Anyway, the logic of my argument aside, Mother and Daddy got the point and abandoned their attempt at really early childhood education. I now think back on that time and laugh. John and Angelina were prepared to try just about anything, or to let me try just about anything, that could be called an educational opportunity. They were convinced that education was the kind of armor shielding me against everything, even the deepest racism in Birmingham and across America. They were bred to those views. They were both born in the South at the height of segregation and racial prejudice. Mother just outside of Birmingham, Alabama in 1924, and Daddy in Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 1923. They were teenagers during the Great Depression. Old enough to remember, but too young to adopt the overly cautious financial habits of their parents. They were of the first generation of middle-class blacks to attend historically black colleges, institutions that previously had been for the children of the black elite. And like so many of their peers, they rigorously controlled their environment to preserve their dignity and their pride. Objectively, white people had all the power and blacks had none. The white man, as my parents called them, controlled politics and the economy. This depersonalized collective noun spoke to the fact that my parents and their friends had few interactions with whites that were truly personal. In his wonderful book, Colored People, Harvard professor Henry Louis Skip Gates, Jr., recalled that his family and friends in West Virginia addressed white people by their professions. For example, Mr. Policeman or Mr. Milkman. Black folks in Birmingham didn't even have that much contact. It was just the white man. Certainly, in any confrontation with a white person in Alabama, you were bound to lose. But my parents believed that you could alter that equation through education, hard work, perfectly spoken English, and an appreciation for the finer things in their culture. If you were twice as good as they were, they might not like you, but they had to respect you. One could find space for a fulfilling and productive life. There was nothing worse than being a helpless victim of your circumstances. My parents were determined to avoid that station in life. Needless to say, they were even more determined that I would not end up that way. My parents were not blue bloods. Yes, there were blue bloods who were black. These were the families that had emerged during Reconstruction, many of whose patriarchs had been freed well before slavery ended. Those families had bloodlines going back to black lawyers and doctors of the late 19th century. Some of their ancestral lines even included political figures, such as Hiram Rhodes Revels, the first black United States senator. There were pockets of these families in the Northeast and a large colony in Chicago. Some had attended Ivy League schools, but others, particularly those from the South, sent their children to such respected institutions as Meharry Medical College, Fisk, Morehouse, Spelman, and the Tuskegee Institute. In some cases, these families had been college-educated for several generations. My mother's family was not from this caste, though it was more patrician than my father's. Mattie Lulab Parham, my maternal grandmother, was the daughter of a high-ranking official, perhaps a bishop, in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Though details about her father, my great-grandfather, are sketchy, he was able to provide my grandmother with a first-rate education for a colored girl of that time. She was sent to a kind of finishing school called St. Mark's Academy and was taught to play the piano by a European man who had come from Vienna. Grandmother had rich brown skin and very high cheekbones, exposing American Indian blood that was obvious if ill-defined. She was deeply religious, unfailingly trusting in God and cultured. My grandfather, Albert Robinson Ray III, was one of six siblings, extremely fair-skinned and possibly the product of a white father and black mother. His sister Nancy had light eyes and auburn hair. There was also apparently an Italian branch of the family on my mother's side, memorialized in the names of successive generations. There are several Altos. My mother and her grandmother were named Angelina. My aunt was named Genoa, though as Southerners we called her Genoa. My cousin is Lativia, and I am Condoleezza, all attesting to that part of our heritage. Granddaddy Ray's story is a bit difficult to tie down, because he ran away from home when he was 13 and did not reconnect with his family until he was an adult. According to family lore, Granddaddy used a tire iron to beat a white man who had assaulted his sister. Fearing for his life, he ran away and later found himself sitting in a train station with one token in his pocket in the wee hours of the morning. Many years later, Granddaddy would say that the sound of a train made him feel lonely. His last words before he died were to my mother. "Angelina," he said, "we're on this train alone."
Who doesn't love David Sedaris? As a regular contributor to The New Yorker and Public Radio International's This American Life, Sedaris has a unique way of looking at life you are going to enjoy. This new collection of animal-themed tales is an utter delight, featuring Sedaris's wonderfully warm blend of hilarity and heart. Though the characters may not be human, the situations in these stories bear an uncanny resemblance to the insanity of everyday life. We're going to be listening to The Migrating Warblers, read by David himself. Other amazing voice talents in the book are Elaine Stritch, Dylan Baker, and Sean Phillips. So get ready to hear an excerpt from Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk by David Sedaris.
The yellow warbler would often claim that she was fine until she hit Brownsville. Then wham, she'd tell her friends. "I don't know if it's the air or what, but whenever we pass it on our migration, I have to stop and puke my guts out." "That she does," her husband would chuckle. "An hour or two's rest is all I need, but isn't it strange? Not Olmedo or Bayview or Indian Lake, but Brownsville every time." The birds she was talking to would try to sound sympathetic or, at the very least, interested. They'd say, or, "Brownsville, I think I have a cousin there." From the southern tip of Texas, the couple would fly over Mexico and then into Central America. "My family's been wintering in Guatemala for as long as I can remember," the warbler would explain. "Every year, like clockwork, here we come by the tens of thousands. But do you think any of those Spanish-speaking birds have bothered learning English? Not on your life." "It's really horrible," her husband would say. "Well, funny, too," his wife would insist. "Horrible and funny. Like one time, I asked this little Guatemalan bird, I said, 'Donde estas las grandes moscas de cabeza?'" Here her listeners would cock their heads, confused and more than a little impressed. "Wait a second, you speak that stuff?" "Oh, I've picked some up," the warbler would say in that offhand way of hers. "I mean, really, what choice do I have? I guess I'm a pretty quick study. At least I've been told I am." "She's terrific with languages," her husband would boast. And his wife would raise a wing in protest. "Well, not always. In this particular case, for instance, I thought I'd asked where all the big horseflies were. A reasonable question, only instead of caballo, which is horse, I said cabeza. So what I really asked was, where are all the big head flies?" Thinking that this was the end of the story, her listeners would quake with polite laughter. "Head flies, oh, that's rich." "But no, wait," the warbler would say. "So the Guatemalan bird makes a motion for me to follow him through the thicket. I do, and there in this field are like 300 heads rotting in the afternoon sun, each one with about 50 flies on it, and I mean huge, the size of acorns, every one of them." "Oh, my God," the listeners would say. "Rotting heads with flies on them?" "Oh, they weren't bird heads," the warbler would reassure them. "These belong to humans, or used to, anyway. Flesh bubbling off, hair all tangled with bits of goo in it. I don't know what they'd done with the bodies. Burned them, maybe. Then they used the heads to make a wall." "Actually, it was more like a counter," her husband would say. "It was a wall, if ever there was one, but what could you do? Ask everyone to stop up their ears, while you and your ridiculous mate, someone who would never even seen a counter except in pictures, scream at each other for half an hour? No, it was best just to breeze over it. So we see this wall, this counter be it, made of human heads, and I mean to say, this place stinks like the devil, but what I actually say is," and here, snorting with laughter, she would pass the baton to her husband. "What she actually says to this small Guatemalan bird is, 'The devil smells me in my place.' Can you believe it? My mate, ladies and gentlemen, or as we like to call her south of the border, Satan's sexy stinkpot." The listeners would crack up, and the warblers, husband and wife, would enjoy the sensation of having an audience right where they wanted them. This was the reward for spending 3 months a year in an inferior country. and when the light fell a certain way, when the laughter surged and melded into a harmonious song, it almost made up for all the hardships, the stomach flus, for instance, or the times when, rather than uniting you and your mate, the strangeness of another culture only made you feel more separate, more despicable and alone. Back in their element, the two warblers were a well-oiled machine. "You want funny? Try getting work done down there," the husband would say, opening the door to their hilarious tales of lazy natives, of how bumbling they were, how backward and superstitious. This begged the question, why go in the first place? Why not winter in Florida like everyone else? The warblers would then explain that despite the incompetence, despite the language barriers and the severed heads, Central America was, in its own way, beautiful. And cheap, they would add. Cheap, cheap, cheap.
Listeners, it's a pleasure to have with me today J.P. Lane, a Jamaican-born writer and globetrotter who has taken the plunge we've all long pondered. Miss Lane has just self-published her first novel, The Tangled Web. It's a revealing page-turner, spanning the globe from the Caribbean to Europe and South America. I've just read it, and the storyline is as timely as tomorrow's headlines. First, Miss Lane, may I ask what the J.P. stands for?
It stands for Joan Elaine, and you may call me that, and thank you.
You're welcome, Joan. Thanks for being here. So, your bio says you've been a writer for many years, a copywriter in an ad agency. What made you decide to tackle fiction?
Actually, fiction was something that I'd always resisted because I didn't think I had it in me, so nobody's more surprised than I that I wrote a novel. It just happened. I had more time. I wasn't as busy, and I started The Tangled Web, and 18 months later, voila, there was a book.
Okay, so now you have a manuscript. What were the steps you took to get it ready for publication?
Well, I was very fortunate in that I'd worked with professional editors all my life, and I had two friends, one in particular, who edited the book for me, and also there was input from friends and family that was very, very valuable. It's not a road that an author takes alone, Elaine. You can't do it by yourself.
Why did you decide to self-publish instead of going with a traditional publishing house?
Well, basically, I didn't want to wait for my book to do the agent publisher rounds. I'm 64 years old. I felt I wanted to get it out as fast as I could.
64, you look damn good.
Thank you.
How did you decide which author-assisted publishing firm to go with?
A little bit of research. There's several of them out there. There's Amazon CreateSpace. There's Lula, that's also very popular with self-published authors. And there's iUniverse, one of the bigger ones. I chose iUniverse because of their, you know, huge distribution.
All right. Tell us about the self-publishing process. How long did it take, and what were the actual steps?
There weren't many steps to take at all. It went very fast from submission of manuscript to when the book was ready for print.
Well, all right.
About 3 months.
Oh, I love the cover. Who did that?
They did the cover.
All right. Now, Joan, that you've been through it all, what are the challenges that come with self-publishing?
I would say, for me, the most immediate challenge is a distribution of the book getting the book onto the shelves of bookstores and booksellers. Although my book, as a case with many self-published novels, is available on the websites of the major booksellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and on. It isn't available in the bookstores, and that's because it's a print-on-demand title. So it is a challenge as an unknown author, or an emerging author with a self-published novel, to actually get your book onto the shelves of the bookstores, the major bookstores, that is.
How do you do that? How do you get the big chains to carry your book in store if their policy is not to stock print-on-demand books?
Reviews, 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 as many as you can get in reputable publications. The booksellers pay attention to that.
I read in Forbes that a few large literary agencies are beginning to open their doors to self-publish submissions. What does that mean for you and other self-published authors?
It's very encouraging news that there are a lot of good self-published titles that deserve to be represented. But again, being accepted by a large literary agency doesn't come without its own demands. The title has to have a track record in order to be considered by publishers. The track record, an author who, say, has sold 5,000 copies of a book is definitely going to be get noticed by a publisher. The challenge, of course, for writers like me who are just emerging and are self-published is to sell 5,000 books in a year. It may not seem like a lot of books to you, but without the muscle of a major publisher behind you, the marketing muscle, it is. It requires very, very aggressive promotion on the part of the writer.
Well, that sounds very daunting to me. How have you promoted your book?
Author appearances and book signings are always part of the plan, but my immediate focus has been online promotion. Email blitzes, nagging everyone I know, send the word out to everyone on your email list, social media like Facebook, Twitter, author websites, reader websites, big ones, say like Author's Den. All this is very valuable, having a blog, having a website, and just every day, just promoting your book via social media.
And how difficult do you find your own promotion?
Very challenging. Very challenging. Promoting a book is as important as writing it, just as important as writing it. If you're going to get your book into the hands of readers, you absolutely are required to promote it, and it's not a sprint, Elaine, it's a marathon.
That's a great analogy. How would you weigh the pluses and minuses of self-publishing now that you've been through it?
I would say the plus, as I said, the plus is that you have complete control over your title. In every aspect, you can get it out there. Of course, you can elect, not to have professional editing services as well. I mean, no writer really wants to do that. So you can have your own way with your manuscript if you want to take that kind of risk or if you're confident enough. On the other side of the coin, you pay for this as a writer. You don't have some publisher saying, and the advances today aren't as much as they used to be, but still, even then, you don't have some publisher saying, well, here's $15,000 for us to publish your book for you.
So I think our listeners, and me too, might like to know about how much it costs to self-publish.
That's very, very variable, and, I can only say how much I paid. I mean, each author-assisted publishing company has their own fees. iUniverse, who I went with, they have a scale, from maybe about $800 to, and then again, I don't want to mention figures. I paid about $1,200 to have my book published with the services that, were required.
Well, I'm surprised. That's actually more reasonable than I had imagined. Okay, back to The Tangled Web. You never mentioned Jamaica by name in your novel, but I take it the story is based on Jamaica?
Yes and no. Yes and no. It's narcotics trading and the corruption associated with it is a main theme in this book, but it's a problem that is endemic to the Caribbean region, and that includes Latin America. However, the irony of it is that that whole mess with the extradition of the drug kingpin Christopher Koch from Jamaica in May, when the U.S. had issued an extradition request for him and Jamaica had refused to comply, which made history because it was the first time a state had actually refused to extradite a known criminal. And this happened about, I would say, exactly the same time that the book was published in May.
Well, after your years of writing and months of promotional work, do you see a big future for your book?
Every writer sees a big future for their book, Elaine. Who doesn't fantasize about being on Oprah? But the truth is, I never had any particular expectations of The Tangled Web. I wrote it for the joy of writing, corny as that might seem. And when it was published, I set out to do the right thing. But interestingly, quite a few readers have said it would make a good movie. And quite by chance, an LA producer, whose name you probably know, thinks it might have what it takes. And that's very flattering and, of course, very exciting.
I think it has what it takes, too. And I just think it's the most amazing book to read on an airplane. When you take out and when you land, you will be totally captivated. Joan, what's the next book coming out of your computer?
I have three books on my computer, right? Three works of fiction, one including a sequel to The Tangled Web, and I'm also working on a screenplay.
Thanks so much, J.P. Lane. Readers, The Tangled Web is a great read. It's available in paperback, Kindle, and ebook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Borders, and Books & Books. We'll be right back. Here's a guy I would follow around the world, and I have, on his weekly travel show, No Reservations. Yes, I'm referring to Anthony Bourdain. I love his unique worldview, his slice it to the bone observations, and I think you're going to love his book, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. In the 10 years since his classic Kitchen Confidential first alerted us to the idiosyncrasies and lurking perils of eating out, for example, I will never eat fish out on a Monday, or the breadbasket conspiracy, much has changed for the subculture of chefs and cooks, for the restaurant business, and for Anthony Bourdain. Medium Raw explores these changes, moving back and forth from the author's bad old days to the present. Tracking his own strange and unexpected voyage from journeyman cook to globe-traveling professional eater and drinker, and even to fatherhood, Bourdain takes no prisoners as he dissects what he sees. He pauses along the way for a series of confessions, rants, investigations, and interrogations of some of the most controversial figures in food. Now, here is Anthony Bourdain reading Medium Raw.
The sit-down. I recognize the men at the bar, and the one woman. They're some of the most respected chefs in America. Most of them are French, but all of them made their bones here. They are, each and every one of them, heroes to me, as they are to up-and-coming line cooks, wannabe chefs, and culinary students everywhere. They're clearly surprised to see each other here, to recognize their peers strung out along the limited number of bar stools. Like me, they were summoned by a trusted friend to this late-night meeting at this celebrated New York restaurant for ambiguous reasons, under conditions of utmost secrecy. They've been told, as I was, not to tell anyone of this gathering. It goes without saying that none of us will blab about it later. Well, I guess that's not exactly true. It's early in my new non-career as a professional traveler, writer, and TV guy, and I still get the vapors being in the same room with these guys. I'm doing my best to conceal the fact that I'm frankly starstruck, a twitter with anticipation. My palms are sweaty as I order a drink, and I'm aware that my voice sounds oddly high and squeaky as the words "vodka on the rocks" come out. All I know for sure about this gathering is that a friend called me on Saturday night, and after asking me what I was doing on Monday, instructed me in his noticeably French accent that, "Tony, you must come. It will be very special." Since leaving all day-to-day responsibilities at my old restaurant Layal and having had to learn or relearn after a couple of book tours and many travels how to deal once again with civilian society, I now own a couple of suits. I'm wearing one now, dressed appropriately, I think, for a restaurant of this one's high reputation. The collar on my shirt is too tight, and it's digging into my neck. The knot on my tie, I'm painfully aware, is less than perfect. When I arrived at the appointed hour of 11 p.m., the dining room was thinning of customers, and I was discreetly ushered here to the small, dimly lit bar and waiting area. I was relieved that upon laying eyes on me, the maitre d' did not wrinkle his nose in distaste. I'm thrilled to see X, a usually unflappable figure whom I generally speak of in the same hushed, respectful tones as the Dalai Lama, a man who ordinarily seems to vibrate on a lower frequency than other more earthbound chefs. I'm surprised to see that he's nearly as excited as I am, an unmistakable look of apprehension on his face. Around him are some of the second and third waves of old guard French guys, some young Turks, along with a few American chefs who came up in their kitchens. There's the godmother of the French chef mafia. It's a fucking who's who of the top tier of cooking in America today. If a gas leak blew up this building, fine dining as we know it would be nearly wiped out in one stroke. Ming Tsai would be the guest judge on every episode of Top Chef, and Bobby Flay and Mario Batali would be left to carve up Vegas between themselves. A few last well-fed citizens wander past on their way from the dining room to the street. More than one couple does a double take at the lineup of familiar faces murmuring conspiratorially at the bar. The large double doors to a private banquet room swing open, and we are summoned. There's a long table, set for 13 people, in the middle of the room. Against the wall is a sideboard, absolutely groaning under the weight of charcuterie, the likes of which few of us, even in this group, have seen in decades. Classic Carême-era terrines of wild game, galantines of various birds, pâté and rillettes. The centerpiece is a wild boar pâté en croûte, the narrow area between forcemeat and crust filled with clear, amber-tinted aspic. Waiters are pouring wine. We help ourselves. One by one, we take our seats. A door at the far end of the room opens, and we're joined by our host. It's like that scene in The Godfather, where Marlon Brando welcomes the representatives of the five families. I almost expect our host to begin with, "I'd like to thank our friends at Tatalia's and our friends from Brooklyn." It's a veritable Appalachian conference. By now, word of what we're about to eat is getting around the table, ratcheting up the level of excitement. There's a welcome and a thank you to the person who procured what we are about to eat and successfully smuggled it into the country. There is a course of ravioli and consommé, quite wonderful, and a civet of wild hare. But these go by in a blur. Our dirty plates are removed. The uniformed waiters, struggling to conceal their smiles, reset our places. Our host rises, and a guéridon is rolled out bearing 13 cast-iron cocottes. Inside each, a tiny, still sizzling, roasted bird, head, beak, and feet still attached, guts intact inside its plump little belly. All of us lean forward, heads turned in the same direction as our host high pours from a bottle of Armagnac, dousing the birds, then ignites them. This is it, the grand slam of rare and forbidden meals. If this assemblage of notable chefs is not reason enough to pinch myself, then this surely is. This is a once-in-a-lifetime meal, a never-in-a-lifetime meal for most mortals, even in France. What we're about to eat is illegal there, as it's illegal here. Ortolan.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again for being a reader of our show. The Book Report comes to you every week at the same time, so listen up and listen in. By the way, Our signature music is by blues artist Erin James, off her Soul Garden album. Thanks, Erin. I'm Elaine Charles, and I'll see you next week. Happy reading!